Hi, and welcome to another edition of Mouse Chat. We're releasing this show a little early because we've got great news. Mouse Chat has been nominated for the 8th Annual Podcast Awards in the Best Travel Podcast category. So we're really excited, and we need your vote. So you can go to podcastawards.com, scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page, and go to the travel category and just click on Mouse Chat and submit your vote. So podcastawards.com. And you should also get a confirmation email. So make sure you click on the link in the confirmation email so your vote counts. You can vote every day from November 1st through the 15th. So once per day for Mouse Chat over at the Podcast Awards. And we really, really appreciate it.
Hi, and welcome to Mouse Chat. I'm Lisa. And our Mouse Chatters today are Bob, Chris, and Steve. And we have a very special guest today. We have the original Dreamfinder, Ron Schneider. Welcome, hello. Everyone.
Hey there.
Hello.
And welcome, Ron. Hello there. Yay. Very excited to have you. How are you tonight?
I'm doing wonderfully, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
We're very happy to have you. Getting a little nervous because, you know, this is the Dreamfinder. You know, what do you ask? There's so many things. Where do you start? I guess we follow the lead of Sound of Music and we start at the very beginning. So,
a good place to start.
Uh-oh, here comes the song.
No.
So, Ron, why don't you go ahead and tell us your first exposure to Disney and how your love for Disney developed?
Well, my first experience with Disney goes back to the opening day of Disneyland, July 18th, the first day it was open to the public. In 1955, my father had done some of the original air conditioning work on the park, and so we had complimentary tickets to attend that very first day, and I was there with my family. I was about 2.5 years old at the time. And grew up going to the park on a regular basis. And it was a constant thing all year. When are we going to Disneyland? When are we going to Disneyland? And so it was a constant presence for me. It was when in 1966, when Walt passed away, I was it just kind of struck me what a tremendous impact he'd had on my life. And from then on, whenever I went to Disneyland, I was taking it very seriously and looking around. By that time, I had already been fascinated with performing and magic and puppetry and always been to performance. And what I sensed at Disneyland was that this was a form of theater and that the guests were the stars of the show. They were stepping up onto the stage. And that's something that very much intrigued me. And so I kind of started taking Disneyland on as a hobby, not collecting things so much as studying the way things worked, the way they were designed. And so I was always recording the rides and taking pictures and video and watching, looking out for anything on television about the parks. And I became fascinated with the idea of performing in that atmosphere. I wanted to be a Jungle Cruise guide. I wanted to be the tour guide at Universal Studios who sat up in the front of the tram with the microphone and would talk for 2.5 hours about movies. Anything like that, any kind of performing like that just fascinated me. And it became a kind of a lifelong passion for me. I read something in the 70s about how it was written by Dick Nunes and Van France, writing about how theme parks work. They said there's no place that studies this. There's no place that teaches how to do this. And when I read that, I suddenly became obsessed with learning it and putting myself on that course of study. So in 1970, I got my very first theme park job at Disneyland. I was in wardrobe issue for the Christmas parade in 1970. The following summer, Six Flags Magic Mountain opened up. I got myself a job as a ride operator there. And from then on, I had very few real jobs. Most of what I did was working in theme parks, theme restaurants, as a performer, then eventually as a writer and director. And overall, did 40 years off and on theme parks with Disney and Universal on both coasts, with Magic Mountain, lots of theme restaurants. And all the time being inspired by the work of Walt Disney and the Imagineers. But always trying to take it to the next level and explore specifically the idea of live performance and how that fit into the themed experience. I wasn't so much into the rides and the design aspect of it, except as it affected the act of storytelling and audience participation. I was always focused on the live performance part, and I've been honored to have a lot of very unique roles and done a lot of things that have never been done before, Dreamfinder being one of them.
So you weren't really focused on the roles like the Jungle Cruise, where it was the same shtick over and over. You wanted to be able to interact and be creative?
Well, actually, everything that I've done has been the kind of role that you have to do over and over and over and over and over. When I was doing the medicine pitch, for example, I used to do a traveling salesman at Magic Mountain. I would do 12 shows a day. And when we did the Golden Horseshoe Review, I would do 5 or 10 shows a day. And the craft is one of making it look like it's never happened before. Mm-hmm. The one job in theme parks that I've never had that I've always wanted is I've always wanted to be a Jungle Cruise guide, doing the same thing over and over again. That's the challenge. That's the real skill of things. I call it the miracle of the first time, and being able to play something off as if it's never happened before. And it's something that everybody in a theme park does, because to the guests, you know, the illusion is that this has never happened before. Even if you've been on, like you said earlier, even if you've been on the Jungle Cruise a million times, there's a thing that the audience does. It's called willful suspension of disbelief. When they step on a ride, they kind of silently agree within themselves, I've never been on this before. Even if they know the thing, even if they know when they walk into the Haunted Mansion, even though they know everything that's going to happen and they know everything that's going to be said, there's something about it's like starting a new story. You know, a child wants to hear the same story over and over again. It's just kind of the slate is wiped clean and you walk into the Haunted Mansion and we kind of pretend we've never been this way before.
Well, that becomes the journey and not the destination.
Exactly. Exactly.
No pun there.
Wow, yeah. That's deep.
Well, that's when you study this stuff too seriously, like I do, you start to get into the levels like that.
No, I mean, that's great. I mean, can I ask you, what impact do you think Wally Bogue had on your career, your life? I mean, seeing him as a teenager.
It's funny. There are 4 or 5 of us. We met up, as a matter of fact. We did a tribute to Wally a bunch of years ago, and back in California. And we were all seated at a table down front. And there are 4 or 5 of us young talents who walked into the Golden Horseshoe, saw Wally Bogue, and said, "I want to do that." And through hook or by crook or by working in the parks or whatever, we eventually all got there. We got to understudy Wally. But we all had that in common. We had that moment. In 1970, I saw Wally Bogue, and I said, I want to be him. And I spent the next 10 years on my own. I was not working for the company at the time. I spent 10 years training myself to be Wally Bogue. So when in 1980, they had the auditions for the 25th anniversary of Disneyland, they were looking to hire a new comic for the Horseshoe, I was able to walk in and be Wally Bogue for them. And Wally took one look at me. He fell off his chair laughing when I was auditioning, doing my medicine pitch. And he's inspired a lot of people. Steve Martin is the most famous one who he inspired.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah, he wrote about him in his autobiography. So it's somebody who's got that kind of close ties with Walt Disney and the Disney legacy and being a Disney legend. Fulton Burley and Betty Taylor, the whole operation of the Golden Horseshoe is an inspiration because of the quality of what they did and the consistency of what they did through the years.
Hmm. So then what do you think about Disney bringing it back for, what is it, a month, I think, at Disneyland for this 52 weeks of celebrations?
Yeah, I'm writing an article about that right now because this is going to be a very interesting experiment. First of all, the show has not been seen in 26 years. And all the people who there are very few people that I know of that are still around that were part of that. But the thing about the Golden Horseshoe was it was lightning in a bottle. That show was not scripted. I mean, they started with a script in 1955. But the things that Wally Bogue and Fulton Burley and Betty Taylor did on that show evolved out of them. Wally Bogue was the show director. And when I got hired at the Horseshoe, Wally said to me, "All right, what do you want to do?" And I said to him, "I want to do some of your stuff. I want to carry on the tradition. I want to bring in some of the stuff that I've been doing for years." And then we developed new stuff on stage, whatever worked. And I can't imagine Disney Creative Entertainment saying, "All right, we're going to hire some great people and leave them alone and do the Golden Horseshoe." They're going to try to recreate it. There are certain people, Terry Robinson, who was Betty Taylor's understudy. I know she's out there somewhere. And Dana Daniels and Dick Hardwick, they're some of the original guys who I know could step back into the role of the traveling salesman at Pecos Bill. But it's lightning in a bottle, and it's going to be very interesting to see how much, how close they come to recreating that horseshoe.
Are you optimistic?
I'm fatalistic. I'm a realist, and got to say, a bit of a skeptic.
Okay.
Now, why did the Diamond Horseshoe go away?
Different theories on that. I think possibly. It's possible. I don't know the hard answer of why the Golden Horseshoe went away. But those people were getting a lot of money.
Yeah.
The show was something that was not controlled. It was its own animal. It was a very definite remnant of Walt Disney's time. And by that time, Eisner had come in. It was not something that Eisner had created. It was changing atmosphere in the park. There's a lot of theories. You know, it's like why did they change the Journey into Imagination? We don't really know, and I don't think we ever will know. But when they brought in the Golden Horseshoe Jamboree, the Diamond Horseshoe Jamboree, that was a scripted show. It was written by Creative Entertainment. They had control of it. They could say, all right, this is right and that's wrong. The Golden Horseshoe was an organic thing. It was its own creation. And I think that possibly that chafed a bit.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, I remember as a kid, speaking of Journey into Imagination, and going to Epcot and waiting in line and going around and around in that queue and that glass elevator that you had to go around over and over again to get finally on the ride. And that was like the best. Maybe it's just because I was a kid, but I remember that like being my favorite ride ever. And now I take my kids and you walk right on and it's just not the same. It doesn't have that big opening scene. And then I remember the DreamWorks or Imagination Works, the area with all the pin tables where you run your fingers over them and just
the image works.
Yes. I remember the image works.
Don't say DreamWorks.
DreamWorks. Yeah. with the tunnel, with the lights and jumping on all the
music.
Yeah. Oh, it was so cool. And now it's like, that upstairs is boarded off. So it's hard. I take my kids there and they still like it. Brooke is three and they think it's okay.
Yeah, but now they have the same thing over and over, just in different places.
Yeah.
You can conduct music or you can create a figment.
So.
I mean, Ron, how do you feel about what's there now? I mean, or do you have any feelings or thoughts about what's there now?
Tons of feelings. The thing that struck people, so you got to go back to what the original purpose of Epcot was.
Yeah.
And how the original Journey into Imagination fit into the overall scheme. Epcot had a unity back when it was opened in 1982 that it was the Inspiration Park. It was a place where people could go to find out about themselves and their place in the world and the options that were open to them in life. And the Journey into Imagination was the Fantasyland part. It was the part that was generally thought of to be specifically for kids. But basically, what the message was, imagination is something that belongs to all of us. And everything at Epcot Center, everything in Future World and everything in World Showcase was born in the human imagination. And this is something that is a power that you have and that there's no limit to what you can do. And the story that was told in the ride was a brilliant evocation of that philosophy. It broke the creative process down into collecting, storing, and recombining sparks of inspiration. And you met these characters, and the Dreamfinder creates Figment out of sparks of inspiration. By the end of the ride, you identify completely with Figment, and you see spread out in front of you the possibilities of your own life. This is why the characters resonate to this day, and I think it's part of the reason why people have such warm feelings for that original ride. When they took out the original ride and put in the Journey into Your Imagination, which was basically a collection of special effects that was, I guess, supposed to inspire your imagination, but everybody missed Figment. And so they went back and they said, well, let's plug Figment in. But when they plugged Figment in, there was no context for him.
He was forced.
And it was forced. And whoever wrote the interaction with Figment was reduced to making him a pest, because that's an easy thing to do. You can have Figment show up and then you go, oh, no, not you again. Get out of here. Because that's the easiest thing in the world to write. The relationship between Dreamfinder and Figment was this nurturing, supportive relationship, the kind of relationship that you want to have with your own kids. There was a real affection there. And Dreamfinder was a representation of that guy who used to host The Wonderful World of Color back on NBC back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. He was an evocation of Walt Disney. And this is all very subtle storytelling stuff that was not at all even attempted in the remake. When we got to Journey into Your Imagination with Figment, we wound up with an upside down house and spraying the audience with skunk smell. And you want the song back? Okay, we'll blast you in the face with a song at the end. Now get out. And so we lost all of the message, all of the meaning, all of the substance of the original ride. And do I have any feelings about it? Yeah, it breaks my heart. The other hand, I do not side with the people who say bring back the original ride, because the original ride was a product of the 1980s. Just like the ImageWorks was a product of the 1980s. And the technologies that were presented in the ImageWorks are everyone has in their laptops. Right. You know, the Magic Palette, the painting program that they had, and the screens everybody was so overwhelmed with. We've all got this in our handheld things. We're playing Draw Me online, you know, with our laptops and our tablets.
Yep.
And it's the same game. So we got to take the next step, but we've got to go back at the same time to the same message, the same original message of that story, and go back and recapture that and bring it into the current time, because we certainly need it. And it's certainly valued. I think the fact that there's a queue line for what's going to be next, and they're talking about bringing Cars Land into the studios. They're talking about bringing Avatar into Animal Kingdom, and now of course everybody's nuts about we're going to build Star Wars Land. I think that the new Journey into Imagination has been pushed back to the back of the line. It's way back, way down.
That pavilion is just empty. Even the movie with Captain EO is back in there, and like you said, it's called it's imagination. It should be the one that's the most creative, the most innovative, the one that you want to go see, and it's the one that no one's touched in forever.
At the same time, we never know what they've got up their sleeves. You know, as I've said before, knowing the way Imagineering works, I have complete confidence that somewhere behind a locked door, somewhere, there's a brilliant imagination ride that's waiting to be built.
Yeah, and they might be waiting for funding. And you get the feeling when you go through the current ride that someone was like, okay, we need to refresh this, and we've got a limited budget, and we've got 6 months. What can you do?
It's funny. I have a friend of mine who works as an Imagineer, and I hadn't seen him in a bunch of years. We were having lunch together a couple of years ago, and we hadn't seen each other in forever. Before we sat down for lunch, he says, "Ron, I have to make a confession. I worked on the Journey into Your Imagination with Figment."
Did you leave right then?
did you say you're paying for lunch?
He said, "I'm terribly, terribly sorry." And I said, I understand, you're forgiven, because budgets and realities and all these things come into something like that. But, the art of the theme park is the art of dealing creatively with operational reality.
Yeah.
And the fact that anything wonderful ever gets done is astounding. And
you have to remember that, Bob.
Yeah. So I find that the Disney company today has about a 50% success rate. Half of the things they do are wonderful. They knock them out of the park. But let us never forget that the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror opened on the same day as Food Rocks.
don't you diss them.
You don't? Why? You like Food Rocks?
Yes.
You liked Food Rocks? Congratulations.
I did. Oh. I did. I mean, it's certainly no comparison, but.
Well, given all of this and striking a balance between the past and now current technology and current times. One of our listeners wanted to know, you know, if Disney came to you and said, we're thinking of bringing back Dreamfinder, would you ever consider, you know, maybe training somebody else for the role? Or I don't know if you have any desire to put on the costume again and get back out there and, you know.
Physically, I'm not up for it. I would give anything to have some input into whatever is done with that type of character again, because I think I have a lot to bring with it. That's part of the reason that I wrote the book. As far as, it's funny because just recently we did the 30th anniversary, celebration at Epcot Center, and I got to make an appearance with Tony and, Steve Taylor, another one, of us Dreamfinders. And I was kind of suspecting, kind of hoping that maybe they'd make an announcement, you know, we got everybody there from D23. It'd be wonderful to announce that. And for the very first time, I actually gave serious thought to what would I do with that pavilion? And I would love to have some kind of input, but playing it myself, I don't think I'm up for it, but I would love to have a hand in bringing that message to audiences again.
Well, there is that great picture of you in your book of you dressed up as Dreamfinder at D23 and holding Figment. Mm-hmm. And it's just a great capture. And it's, you know, seems like old times. I mean, the way you're looking at each other. I mean, that alone is probably worth the price of the book. I know you said at the Communicore Weekly event when you were talking that, it wasn't exactly comfortable either. I mean, the way you had to hold Figment and walk around with them and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you kind of had to, the way you had to hold your hand
it was physically challenging. The person, God bless him, whoever sculpted Figment, he was not sculpted for ease of animation. And normally when Disney does these things, they do a lot of work in something like that, but they'd never done anything like Figment before. And the constraints of the design of the character and trying to capture that, as I discovered, I was on my own completely in pulling that thing together and in learning to animate him. And I had some puppeteering experience, which came in handy. But you had to hold him in a very unnatural position in order to make it look like the arm that comes out of the jacket that looks like it's supporting Figment. Mm-hmm. In order to keep it, to make it look like that arm is under him and supporting him, you had to hold the arm that was in the puppet. You had to bring your elbow uncomfortably forward. You had to tuck your hand back. You had to bend your thumb down to get him in the lower jaw. It was quite a bit of a strain and took some getting used to. So it became second nature.
Fair. And then walk around and smile and interact with guests all at the same time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, you don't really see much of that anymore. I mean, at the Disney parks, I mean, you have meet and greet characters and, you know, face characters and princesses and things, but you don't really have that type of interaction anymore.
It's a shame. I grew up at Disneyland when the characters were free roaming and there were surprises and chances to interact. And it was a wonderful thing. And now it's very controlled and the audience, you know, they're kept in pens and the audience is lining up and it becomes the opportunity of grinding out photographs and autograph books. When autograph books appeared while I was there, to me, it took a lot of the charm out and the guest interaction tended to become a matter of the parents saying, all right, we got to get this picture and this autograph and this picture and this autograph. And
more of a scavenger hunt.
Exactly. Exactly. And for my interaction with the guests, part of my mission, I felt, was to carry forth the theme of what was in the ride. So I was determined going in. I mean, by that time, I had been doing theme parks for 12 years, and I was interested in just being a photo op. I had this wonderful character, this brilliant creation that I wanted to bring to life, and I wanted to carry forth the message of Journey into Imagination. And so I had to find a way, in spite of that mindset that the audience had, to get them to play with me, to get them to interact with me imaginatively. And I discovered that if I treated the guests as sparks of inspiration, it's like something straight out of the first scene of the ride, then I could get them to look at themselves in a different way, and the whole interaction could become very entertaining, not only for them, but for the people, the mob of people who were standing around waiting to have their picture taken. We became a show and not just a photo op. And that I found terribly rewarding.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's great. And it sounds like, you know, it wasn't as controlled as everything is today. Like you said, I mean, you know, they're not, you weren't in a pen. There wasn't somebody from, you know, Disney corporate walking around looking over your shoulder and, you know, monitoring everything you did.
Yeah. Epcot was very spread out. And we were way the heck the other side of the park from the entertainment offices. And so we very, very rarely saw anybody from management. We were out on our own. I had to discover my own way to manage the crowd and to control the crowd and control who was going to get their picture taken next so that the whole thing didn't fall into complete havoc. And so I had to develop a whole different set of crowd control techniques for using the character and for controlling the character. And that was wonderful that, you know, I'd been studying that kind of stuff for a while already, but I had to learn a whole set of new rules for Dreamfinder, as I have in just about all the different jobs I've had. Every job has presented different crowd control, different sightline and audio challenges. And for me, throughout my career, part of the thrill has been solving all those individual problems.
Well, I've got to ask the textbook very predictable question here. As far as the guest interactions go, what stands out as one of your most memorable moments or your funniest moments with the guest interaction?
The thing about doing the Dreamfinder is I went from being the Golden Horseshoe Review to doing Dreamfinder. With the Golden Horseshoe, you're standing on stage in front of 310 people in air-conditioned splendor. The audience has stood in line outside in the heat to get in to see the show, and they laugh at everything you do, and you get all these wonderful strokes, and you're working with all these wonderful people. And I went from that to being alone in my dressing room in this pavilion, stepping out into 105 degree heat, and you get your stroke to get your feedback from the look on the child's face in front of you, and from the way of, if you can draw the audience into playing with you, and that's your reward. So your strokes are where you find them. The classic story, the one I told many times, is about the little boy. I was on my way back to my dressing room one day. I just finished with the set, and I was on my way, and I break through this group of this audience. I'm about 5 feet away from the door that leads me backstage to my dressing room, and there's this little boy looking up at me, his eyes as big as saucers. And I look around. There's no other kids around, so I know I'm safe. I can talk to him for a minute, and I won't get swamped. I kneel down. I introduce him to my arm. And we talk for a while, and finally, and he's just awestruck. He can't say a word, nothing. And I'm handling the whole conversation. Finally, I stand up. I said, "Well, I got to go now. Goodbye." And he says, "Bye bye, Jesus." Goodbye, Jesus.
Well, see, you missed your calling at what is that?
Oh, place at Holy Land.
Holy Land. There you go.
Is that even still there?
He had tears pouring down his eyes. And everybody, of course, is standing around laughing hysterically. And that was a very touching moment for me.
Because Jesus wore, you know, that lovely bluish purple suit.
And had a dinosaur. Well, he created dinosaurs. Yeah, there you go.
I just pictured the guy when he got home. He says, "Yeah, I met him. He has two heads and he called me by my name."
It was awesome. It was great. There he was in Epcot Center. You know, that's terrific. You know, one of the funniest stories in your book was, to me, the whole thing with Wompopper's Restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Waxworks.
Yes. And one of our other fans, listeners, Joshua actually asked, he's like, would you ever consider opening your own version of that restaurant? Or have you thought of, you know, becoming a restaurateur? A restaurant owner.
Okay. As a matter of fact, I love themed restaurants. To me, they're the best version of what we do because it's the long form. You got the audience in there. They sit down, and you've got them throughout a meal. If you're doing a stage show, you've got a two-hour window, and you can cast the audience as characters in the story being told, and you can feed them in a way that reinforces the story, and you can tell a story. It's not like a theme park show where it's just a meet and greet, or you've only got 15 or 20 minutes, and you're competing with Space Mountain. So I love themed restaurants, and I've done like seven of them.
Oh, wow.
And to me, it's the most rewarding and exciting form of what we do. And I do have a concept of something that I'm would like to do. And we're looking at a spot. And to give you an idea, it's the idea is to do something that would be kind of a parody of the Disney dining experience. Something with characters that's got a Disney feel to it, but a Universal Studios mentality.
I like that. See,
a little
like
it's
already.
Like a little Avenue Q dining experience, maybe.
So we're looking for backers. So if you're listening in, get in touch with me if you've got money.
There you go.
Oh darn! I was with you until that last to that very last sentence. I was totally with you.
We can support you in many ways, but.
Yeah, but not financially. But I'm there in spirit, and if it gets off the ground, I would definitely.
You go online nowadays, and there's so much great comic material being put out there. People who are parodying the Disney characters and the Disney experience. I think there's a tremendous demand for something. Disney tried. Remember, they had that show called Forbidden Disney, that was at Pleasure Island when it opened.
Oh, I never saw that.
And very few people remember it, but the Comic Warehouse originally housed a show called Forbidden Disney, in which Disney tried to make fun of themselves, but they weren't prepared to do it. You know, they said, okay, well, we're going to have some fun with the Disney image, but the fact is Disney can't make fun of themselves because they are Disney, and they can't really recognize or make jokes about themselves because they're – that would go against their philosophy. There's a wonderful story about when they were putting that show together, they were presenting the idea for it to one of the top Disney executives, someone who'd been around since the beginning. And he said, well, what is this Forbidden Disney thing? And I said, well, we're going to do the show, and we're going to make fun of the Disney experience. What do you mean make fun of it? I said, well, the things that people have to go through when they're at the parks that, he says, what, you mean like the weather? And that's as far as the show ran for a while. But the problem was the show was beautifully produced, but it wasn't funny because Disney couldn't actually take a swipe at itself because they have to take itself very seriously. Well, what I have in mind is the kind of thing Disney wouldn't do. But
see,
the same
I like this more and more. I've this is right up my alley.
It's done loving. It's done lovingly. I mean, I want it to feel have that wonderful, warm feeling, and give people an experience of the theme park characters that they wouldn't get anywhere else.
No, that's great. You know, and plus that whole story. I mean, again, another great reason to buy the book is the whole Womp Popper story and. You know, with the balloon animal with the kid and the, it's just, I don't know. I found it to be a very, you know, it's just interesting to me the situations you've found yourself in throughout your career, you know, and I don't know. It's just, you know, and you've always seemed to have a very sharp sense of humor, you know, about you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Hey, Ron, what do you think? We touched on it a little bit, but what do you think about the direction, I guess, themed entertainment's going, the direction Disney's going, purchasing Star Wars, which is the latest acquisition? Do you sound like a positive thing, or is it just kind of buying movies and making a new land and not as creative? Or
well, the only thing that's frustrating me about it, I think it's wonderful. The only thing that's frustrating for me about it is the fact that Disney didn't just buy Star Wars, everybody. Folks, Disney bought ILM.
It's even better.
Industrial Light and Magic. They own Skywalker Sound. They own all that new technology.
Yeah.
You know that there is not a major film out there nowadays that isn't handled, that doesn't go through ILM. And Disney's got all that technology and all that brain trust and all those creative people working for it. I mean, forget, let's all try just for a second to take our minds off of Star Wars, you know, and realize what a gem Disney has picked up here. What a gem George Lucas has gifted the company with so that he can take $4 billion and invest it in education. I mean, this is a wonderful thing that's going through. However you feel about the idea that they're going to do an episode 7. Now, you probably have read about me in the papers because I'm the guy who liked all 6 episodes of Star Wars.
Even episode 1?
Even episode 1. Yes, I love them all. I understand what happened with Jar Jar Binks, and it was a mistake to a certain extent, but I understand why they did him the way they did him. I understand what the point was, and the fact is that here's a guy, George Lucas, he did something no one has ever done before. He got his vision up on the screen the way he wanted to see it, with no compromises. Episodes 2 and 3, there were no compromises. He got exact, and everybody's in there critiquing as if they know what he wanted to do better than he did. You know, the fact that you own an annual pass does not give you the right to dictate how Disney runs their parks, and the fact that you love the original Star Wars films doesn't give you the right to dictate how George Lucas makes his movies. There, that's the end of that lecture.
I knew that was coming. Yeah, because I'm the guy I'm the complainer.
I understand, and you're not alone. You're the vast majority of people out there, even people who don't know anything about Star Wars, have leapt on the let's all trash Episode 1 because of Jar Jar Binks. And I understand that, but as you know, if you're a Star Wars fan, Episodes 7, 8, and 9 have been on paper for as long as most of us have been alive.
Yeah,
he wrote them long, long time ago. And
in a galaxy far away.
That was funny too. And so I for one, I have been given a new reason to live with the thought that I may actually get to see Episode 7. And look what Disney's done with the Marvel universe. It's wonderful. But the idea that George Lucas is going to be on board now as a creative consultant, Kathleen Kennedy's going to be on board as a creative consultant. They got John Lasseter there. They've got so much on board, so many wonderful things on board. I mean, this is a wonderful, wonderful time for the company. As far as where theme parks are now, this is, I contend, the greatest art form ever invented by man. Better than films, better than anything else we can do, because the art of the theme park is to create an environment that embraces all the other arts. Great painting, great cooking, great topiary, great architecture, great music, great sculpture, all of it, cutting edge technologies, all come together in one place to tell a story. And the medium is the guest experience. Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. But in the theme park, the audience is the medium. It's not important. The Haunted Mansion isn't what it's about. It's about the guest experience of the Haunted Mansion. This is an art form that is just now starting to come into its own. And there's all sorts of exciting work that's being done, and it's being done, most of it's being done by former Imagineers, people who came in, learned from Disney, and realized, I can't cut loose here. I'm going to go work for Universal, or I'm going to go work for Bob Rogers, or I'm going to go work for Landmark Entertainment. And now they're all over the place. And so we've got the Harry Potter experience, and we've got Spider-Man, and we've got all these wonderful things, these new technologies that are coming around all over the place that are expanding this art form. Now, my field is live performance. And this is something that hasn't progressed as far or as fast. Because that would mean we would have to hire talented people and put them out on the street and trust them to create. And I've been lucky with the things that I've done, like Dreamfinder and Womp Hop or the Golden Horseshoe, where I've been kind of left to my own to create these characters and to explore what could be done one-on-one with the guests. Where the cutting edge of live interaction is, you go to Renaissance fairs. And folks, if you've never been to a Renaissance fair, Hy-Vee there quickly, because there the inmates are running the asylum. And you've got these wonderful people creating these wonderful characters, and then they confront the guests and they challenge the guests. And this is the future of live performance in this field. Disney has this wonderful thing they're doing called the Living Character Initiative, in which they're creating new ways of bringing the characters to life. And so they've got Mickey and the gang who now can emote. They can move their mouths and move their eyes, and they have Turtle Talk with Crush and the Monsters Incorporated Laugh Floor. They've got them the Muppet Labs that rolls around and all the wonderful things that are out there, but they're all technical. They're all putting a technical thing edge on things, where the one-on-one interaction with a living character, you know, there aren't a lot of them out there. And the ones that aren't in pens with a cue line can do wonderful things, can touch people in a wonderful way. The idea of the new girl from Brave, what's her name?
Merida.
Thank you, Merida.
Merida.
I was
Merida,
close.
Merida to me is the closest thing we have to the Dreamfinder because she's a woman with an agenda. She isn't. She doesn't take guff from anybody. She is her own woman, and there are ways that she could interact with the children and with the people to be that feisty character and bring that message to life for people. And to me, she's the most exciting thing going out there in the character world if they allow her that freedom, if they put somebody out there. But there's wonderful things to be done. I went on the Peter Pan flight the other day at the Magic Kingdom, and the girl who was at the dispatch post, the girl who pushes the button that sent me off on the ride, she looked just like Tiger Lily. Now, she wasn't Tiger Lily. She wasn't dressed like Tiger Lily, but she was this beautiful Asian woman with the long, straight hair and the noble look on her face, and she was just stunningly beautiful. And I turned and I looked at her and I said, "You're Tiger Lily." And just the emotional lift that gave me to be sent to Neverland by Tiger Lily. It's a small thing, but it gave that whole trip, that whole launch, an entirely different feeling. They used to have Alice in Wonderland, used to be operate the ride dispatch at Disneyland on the Alice in Wonderland ride. They had a girl that dressed as Alice.
Huh.
And this kind of personal interaction with the guests, that's the cutting edge of themed entertainment. And it's a thing that nobody's doing anything with outside of the Renaissance fairs. And it's long overdue, and it'll happen. Oh. It'll happen eventually.
Perhaps they need to run their parks a little bit like their commercials.
Yeah, very good.
Well, no, I mean, does this mean? Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds like live entertainment. I mean, the art form that you spent your life in is dying in the theme parks because the focus is on
technology.
You know, the next big technology, the next big attraction, the next big Space Mountain or Transformers or Harry Potter or, you know, World of Avatar or, you know, whatever it is.
I wouldn't say it's dying. I would say that it's never truly lived. It's always kind of crept in under the radar. You know, in my book, I talk about the experience I had at Universal Studios back when it opened in the early 90s in Florida. Management was so wrapped up in getting those rides working that they left us alone in live entertainment. And so I was in charge of the celebrity lookalikes. And I had the Blues Brothers, Marx Brothers, and Laurel and Hardy and Beetlejuice working for me. And
That'd be fun.
This wonderful atmosphere of benign neglect. Nobody told us what to do. And my boss, who was as big a fan of the Marx Brothers and the Blues Brothers and Laurel and Hardy as I was, all he wanted from me was to bring those characters to life. So we could go nuts. And it was Universal Studios. We weren't Disney. So we could be – the Marx Brothers could be the Marx Brothers, not just a photo op, but they could be wild, unpredictable characters that impacted the guests and in subtle and not so subtle ways. And the Blues Brothers could be renegades. They could be suspicious. They could mix things up. And so we proved the way that we acted by being in my troupe. We proved this stuff works and that it's impactful. And the guests had a wonderful time with us, like they couldn't with the Disney characters who were restrained to, you know, miming and curtsying and signing autographs and blowing kisses.
Well, Disney does have a few street performers, so to speak.
Oh yeah,
that are wonderful.
Yes, they do. There's these streetmosphere people on Main Street at Hollywood Boulevard. They're wonderful people, and they hire charming, wonderful people, and they dress them exquisitely. But as far as impacting the guests are concerned, they're not drawing the guests in, involving the guests. They become something that you watch and you enjoy. They enjoy them thoroughly. Mm-hmm. But when you play cards with the Marx Brothers in the morning at Universal Studios, you were playing cards with the Marx Brothers. And that's the kind of personal experience that Streetmosphere could stretch into, that they could I remember when they first started Streetmosphere, I did a lot of writing for them when they first started putting that thing out there, and I wrote a lot of sketches that had the guests interacting with the actors. They would rather just have them out there being charming and funny to look at, but not quite so engaging, not quite so much personal involvement.
Yeah, and now even Universal has gotten away from what you describe. I mean, you don't see the Marx Brothers or Beetlejuice running around. I mean, Beetlejuice is in a show, or you might see the Blues Brothers drive by in a vehicle, but you see the Marvel characters, but they run out, they pose for pictures, they sign autographs, and they jump back on their dirt bikes
from
or whatever.
Here to there.
Yeah, and that's it. Yeah.
Universal decided a couple of years ago that nobody knew who the Marx Brothers were. Nobody knew who Laurel and Hardy were, so they got rid of them.
I grew up on Laurel and Hardy. I love them.
They kept the Blues Brothers show that I created, but they now it's just basically a concert, and they've kind of taken out whatever emotion there was. The Blues Brothers were a very emotional pair. That was the humor in them, that they weren't just these musicians, but there was a lot of emotion. There was a lot of passion in what they did, and a lot of mischief in what they did. And that's kind of become plasticized in the year. We had a wonderful team of people that did a lot of very subtle, very funny things with the characters. But I recently went there. They're still doing the Christmas show, the Blues Brothers Christmas show that I created, but they're not taking the time with it. And they've taken most of the comedy bits now are they just kind of run through them without having any of the emotional impact that we had.
It's like Lisa was saying. I mean, it seems like the focus is on technology now, and if it's not Forbidden Journey, if it's not New Fantasyland, if it's if it's not the next big thing, if it's not cutting edge,
and we see that there's a wonderful example of that deficit in the wonderful story time with Belle. The whole Belle storytelling experience. You come into this cottage, and they have this wonderful magic mirror, and they have this brilliantly animated wardrobe, and then the wonderful figure of Lumiere.
Yes.
Who is everything. Yeah. And then we do the same storytelling show that we did in the storytelling garden. Same level of guest interaction and the same rehashing of the same story. And so we've had this wonderful build up to the same thing where the audience is just going through the motions with the characters,
and it's a photo op, and let's sell the photo pass, that is a shame. I mean, given your vast experience, I mean, 40-year career in shows and entertainment, and I mean, working with Magic Mountain and Universal and all kinds of Disney and all kinds of roles. I mean, if you could do any role, if you were given the opportunity, you can do any role for any of those companies, again, I mean, what would you choose?
I'll go back to being a Jungle Cruise guide. It's the only thing, unless there's something new that comes up that is going to, it's going to be an opportunity like that. But so one thing I've never done, and that you're left to your own devices, although it is very carefully managed, of course. But I would still love to be the guy in the front of the
boat. They do make or break the show. I mean,
absolutely.
On that ride and you get a really good skipper, it's a totally different experience than if you don't. If you get somebody who's earning their ears, it's, and they're kind of playing it by the book and they're not ad-libbing, and they're not being funny. It's torture,
It can be, but at the same time, I go back to the philosophy that behind the ride, that the ride, the totality of the ride is the star. And one of the things that there was a while there when I was actively trying to get in there, And the thing, the challenge that I wanted to take on was I wanted to see if you could do the Jungle Cruise and while you had the humor in there, but play and get back to playing it for real. I think that there's a lot to be mined there besides the comedy and, to explore that whole balance between the environment and the guest situation and the host and bring the balance more to the storytelling aspect of it. I think that there's a lot there that could be played with and explored with. I was always intrigued with the Great Movie Ride, the idea of putting live actors in the ride. And they did a wonderful job with that as far as they took it. But there's a lot of stuff that you can do when you put live performance in something like that. That's why I was on the opening crew of the Monsters Incorporated Laugh Floor, which I found it was a fascinating laboratory. And then I worked on Titanic, the exhibition, for 6 years as an actor guide over there, telling the story of Titanic and taking people through the story. There's wonderful lessons to be learned there about storytelling, characterization, audience involvement. And these are all things that I would like to continue to explore in any venue. So I'm still very much, my heart is still in it.
Well, if you have any suggestions for the Great Movie Ride that you can send to Disney, please, they need that. No, it's true. That ride really needs it.
It does.
It hasn't been updated in, feels like decades. I mean, has it even been updated since it opened? I don't think it has.
The film
on the outside has. Yep. Okay.
The film at the end has. I think that I would love to see them take that and make it an Omnimover ride, where you had far more scenes and a much closer contact with things. As it is now, the idea of the moving theaters kind of sets everything off at a distance. Whereas if it was an Omnimover ride like the Haunted Mansion, where everything was in closer and you were in the scenes more, I think it's ripe. The theme is it's a wonderful thing, is ripe for redoing. But Now, first of all, we have to get to Cars Land, and we've got to get to Avatar, and we've got to get to Star Wars. And so everything's kind of been pushed back in the line.
Yeah. Everybody gets knocked down a peg or two or 10.
and I would like to real quick point out, for the Great Movie Ride, I want the bubbles back.
Oh, the bubbles were broken. We were there a couple months ago, yeah.
I don't think they do them anymore. In that first room with the
dancers,
the musicals,
the tribute to to inflatable women mannequins. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That one.
Yeah.
Now you did bring up Avatar. What are your here on the show? We've had mixed emotions about Avatar. A lot of us can't remember any of the key characters in the movie. We did like the movie and the visual effects. And for a while there, we had heard that it was on and off, and then we thought it was off. And then all of a sudden some plans showed up a week or two ago on the internet, some, air conditioning diagrams that show a boat ride and a movie ride.
Assuming those are real. But I find them very, very plausible because, they do the one thing that, you could do well with the idea. And that is, a flight simulator, a 3D movie projection thing with 3D glasses and motion base and stuff like that, which is, which is what you picture when you think of doing something with Avatar. Because the thing about the Avatar, the way that film, that first film was, and let's remember, there are going to be two more of them. The first film, it was a very fragile environment, a very fragile story. And where are the shops? Where is the atmosphere that a guest could walk through and interact with without destroying the setting? There isn't one. Not in that first movie. In the first movie, you had the technology side of thing, and then you had this very fragile natural environment that is going to suffer when it's being transferred into the real world. In the plans, they put you in a boat, and they put you in a flight simulator with a projection like Soarin'. And so those plans to me have that plausibility only because that's what whoever did those plans mocked them up as. But there are going to be two more Avatar films. At least one of those is going to be out before the next time before we see any kind of a clue of what Disney's going to do. So, I mean, the Avatar with the Avatar planet may in the second film be filled with shops.
And butterbeer.
And all that. So we don't know what's coming.
You know? And
Jar Jar Binks.
Merchandise and Jar Jar Binks will be there.
He'll make a cameo in the world of Avatar.
So we don't know. That is the bottom line on most of the things that with speculation that guests make about bring back Mr. Toad. We don't know what they're doing. You know, Disney Imagineering has people who do nothing but travel the world looking at new technologies, researching new stories. They're so far ahead of us, and we're sitting here with a little annual pass is going, well, they should build a Star Wars land. They should, all we know is regurgitating what we've seen.
Yeah.
And they're coming up with Expedition Everest and Pirates of the Caribbean and Journey into Imagination, stuff that we can't possibly imagine. So my job is to be a fan and to say, surprise me, show me something new. I don't want to be able to guess what's coming down the pike. Yeah. I want Imagineering to be Imagineering, and I want to be the guy who walks in and sees something. You know, I took my daughter when she was 6 years old. I took her to Disneyland, and she hadn't been since she was a baby. She had no memory of the place, and I walked her. We went straight over to Peter Pan's flight, and she said, "Oh, Daddy, what happens here?" And I said, "I don't know. I have no idea." And the whole weekend, it was her and me on every ride. I gave her no clue of what was in the rides. And that's the way we need to all be, is just stop assuming. Yeah, like a child. Very good, like a child.
Hey, I got one right. All right.
You're going to remember that, Bob. I'm going to bring that up again when you start complaining next time.
Well, you're not making this easy for me, Ron, because you make a valid point, and I guess I am kind of like a sideline quarter. What do you call that? Like a sideline quarterback,
or an armchair
quarterback. Yeah, I'm trying to call the shots from the sidelines.
Everybody, because we care passionately about it.
And that's just it. I mean, I don't do it because I hate it. I do it because I love it.
And I mean,
when they do something great, I'm going to say, hey, that's great. But when they do something that, boggles my mind, I kind of feel like, saying like, what are you doing?
Bob is very misunderstood.
I am.
It's hard.
I am. Yeah.
The thing is, this is a business in which we are. It's like I was talking about how Epcot had this purity, this mission. Back in 82. And the reason it was able to be like that was because upper management, Card Walker, Don Tain, and Ron Miller, got out of the way and said to the Imagineers, all right, build what you want to build the way you want to build it. You don't want Mickey Mouse in the park. We won't have Mickey Mouse in the park. Can you imagine Disney making that choice now? There are all these things that we've got to, thanks to Mr. Eisner, everything is a profit center now. Everything's got to have 20% annual growth, every section of the company. And these are all things that now influence what goes into these rides and what gets selected to be built and what scope it has and what budget it has and what realities it has to deal with and how big is the souvenir store going to be at the end of the ride. And everything has to have to make a return. So these are all the things that influence and get in the way of everything we're doing taking flight.
Well, I mean, doesn't that take away from what these Imagineers who are traveling the world and looking for ideas and trying to be creative? I mean, doesn't it take away from them when they,
It's all creative compromise. It's all, like I say, dealing creatively with operational reality. If somebody says to you, all right, I want you to build this incredible attraction about we're going to fly to Neverland, but we've only given you this much space and we're only going to give you this much money, you then have to find a way to create that magic within that space and with that budget. That's the magic of Imagineering. That's why it's imagination and engineering. They have to deal creatively with those limitations. And if you get to the point where the limitations start cutting into what you're doing, then you have to look at what you're trying to do and adjust that. You know, you have right. to, it's a give and take. It's a back and forth constantly. And it doesn't stop when the ride opens. You have to take into account what happens when the guests come aboard, because the guests are the only ones who really tell you what you have. And then you have to, there's always test and adjust. That's why you always go to these rides when they first open, because you may never see them like that again.
Right.
And things get tested and adjusted and changed, and hopefully for the better. That's why this whole science is so fascinating to me.
Well, I think to a degree to me as well, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of competition too, it seems, among fans, as far as, you know, the different parks. I mean, you know, there are diehard Disney people who I'll never step foot in Universal, and Universal is that dark, shadowy place where you must never go. I mean, do you think that's a little silly? I mean, I kind of take the viewpoint that, you know, the competition is healthy between the theme parks. I mean, it can only make them better for the guest experience.
It's not, for me, it's not a little silly. It's ridiculous. They think they're having some effect by refusing to go to Universal Studios. Now, last time I went to Universal Studios, I was so inundated with constant signs saying spend more money that my feeling is I don't really want to go back there, because the atmosphere of, oh, please give us another $30 and we'll give you a discount on fried chicken. Oh, please give us another $45 and you won't have to wait in any more lines. And the signs are everywhere, and the chips into the magic. Disney does the same thing, but it's in its place. You don't see it everywhere. And you know, everybody's charging $14 to park, and I accept that. You know, that's fine. Yeah. I'll go with an employee so I don't have to pay it. But the idea of I'm going to boycott the park. The thing is, when you boycott Universal, you don't get to go on Spider-Man.
Right.
And you get to go on Cat in the Hat, which is a flawless experience. And of course, I don't get to go on Harry Potter anyway, because I'm fat. And Universal decided, well, fat people shouldn't be allowed on this ride. Well, that's okay. Well, I don't want to be denied Spider-Man. You know, so they're only hurting themselves when they try to break out these things. They're not making any points. Of course, thanks to Facebook, everybody has a say, and everybody has a voice, and everybody thinks I'm going to stand up and make a case. But no, it's, to me, it's ridiculous.
Well, everybody's an expert now, like you said.
Everybody's an expert.
You know, it's so much easier now. You know, to, you know, you go on the internet and you know, learn anything you want to know about Disney and Disney history, and you know, here you are as a kid and growing up and collecting pamphlets and brochures and you know, and scraping information where you can get it. You know.
Okay. Well, I think I'm going to jump in right here and bring us to a close. I would certainly like to thank Mr. Ron Schneider for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure. And if I may, here it comes, gang. Brace yourselves. The name of the book is From Dreamer to Dreamfinder, A Life and Lessons Learned in 40 Years Behind a Name Tag. And it's available on Amazon.com or through iTunes. We got an audiobook. Hardcover just came out. You also get it from the publisher, BambooForestPublishing.com. So send in those checks. I'm sorry. My publisher would have killed me if I had.
No. Plugs are welcome.
No, Leonard's not that kind of guy. Or maybe he is. I don't know. I mean, with that disguise of his.
I've never seen him without the mask. It's really disturbing.
I think it's really nice. Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I'm like, wow, he's young. He's younger than me. And he owns a publishing company.
Yeah.
What am I doing with my life? you know, but at least he's auctioning it off for charity. I thought that was
that's
great.
That's right. I heard that. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's great for Give Kids the World, and so that's really nice. But no, and I can personally vouch that, having, you know, made my way through half the book, it really is good, and I don't say that lightly. And I mean, it's charming. It's easy to read. It's very enjoyable. It's funny. You know, so definitely. You know, take advantage, like Ron said, and get yourself a copy.
Perfect Christmas gift.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys. This has been a joy.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
It's been an honor. definitely.
Well, I'd also like to thank pixievacation.com for sponsoring the podcast. You can go to iTunes or you can go to mousechat.net to download our shows. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear them. Send those to us at comments@mousechat.net. And please join us again here next time on Mouse Chat.